All right, welcome to B-Movies and E-Books. My name's Craig Wade.
And I'm Brian Allen Delaney.
And basically, we want to just, this whole podcast, the whole reason we even started this is because we like B-Movies. We like all sorts of horror, crime, thriller, and, you know, all sorts of genre movies. And I'm a writer, and so I avidly read. And so we decided to basically just get a podcast together to talk about, you know, the kind of shit that we're into. Brian, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm a composer. I've been writing more or less for about 10 years, but mostly concert music. Recently, I've gotten into writing music for films the last 6 months or so. It's always been a passion of mine ever since I was a little kid. I've always actually paid attention to the score, which is kind of weird, but it's just something that's always been there with me. And so, you know, I figured might as well do it for a living.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're composing anyway, you know, and you love movies, why not join the two?
Yeah. Why not? It makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, like I said, you know, this is just kind of a podcast for us to geek out about all the kinds of shit that we're into. And pretty much right now today, we got a review coming up later for Joe Lansdale's Bullets and Fire. It's a short story you can get for free on Amazon.
Probably going to be spoilers.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay.
I mean, it's going to happen. Probably.
And then we got an interview lined up with Billy Garbarina. He's an awesome director and actor. He's been in a lot of good movies, and so that'll be coming up later. But first, Brian, have you seen the new trailer for The Green Inferno?
I have. It looks amazing.
Yeah, I just went and saw Deliver Us from Evil, which I was not a fan of.
Okay.
And before the movie, like, they ran the trailer for it, and I was like, shit, why am I not watching that movie right now? Like, it looks really good. Definitely looks like a Cannibal Holocaust. Like, Eli Roth watched Cannibal Holocaust and was like, you know what? I'm going to do this my way. And I don't know. I'm excited about it. I think that... if anyone can revitalize the horror genre, Eli Roth can.
Horror genre?
Well, I'm just saying that the horror genre in general, right now, it's kind of stagnant. There's only been a few, only been a few that have come out in the past year that have even gone to theaters. And most of those are freaking possession movies.
Like Oculus.
Which I don't know.
Could kind of call it a possession movie. Because, I mean, there was definitely parts where they were unaware of what they were doing. But
Oculus, I was a big fan of Oculus.
I was as well.
But, I mean, you remember, like, whenever Hostel came out and everyone jumped on the coattails of that. And I'm not even saying that, you know, I like Eli Roth movies. I don't think he's the greatest filmmaker in the world or anything. But for some reason, people take notice. And all of a sudden... people jump on the coattails, and I think that if he can kind of bring it back to, I mean, I don't really want to see 50 movies about cannibalistic tribes.
You're probably going to, though.
But since we're going to, let's just hope it's good.
I mean, how many Asylum films do you think are going to be about cannibals after this?
Oh my God. That's going to be awesome, though. Shark cannibals. You know, just like retarded stuff. But anyway,
so how was Deliver Us from Evil?
I wasn't a big fan. I don't think it was a bad movie at all. It didn't really connect with me. They had, like, Joel McHale was in it,
mm-hmm.
and he could not have been more just like, I'm the wisecracking buddy cop. You know, like, he just played so much into, like, a stereotype that it detracted from the movie. Plus, it really wasn't, it was good. It just wasn't suspenseful or scary or anything. Basically, It was much more of just a cop movie. And all the reviews I saw were like, oh, yeah, this is like the new Seven. No, not at all. Not to me, at least. But, I mean, there were only four people in the theater, and we all looked disappointed when we left.
Wow. So, oh, well, this wasn't opening week, though.
No, and plus, it was at 1 o'clock on Friday.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, and plus it was also at Star Cinema, which, you know, they don't let anyone in that's under 18. So, you know, there were no kids in.
Which I hate to sound like a snob, but I actually like.
Yeah, I guess they let people in as long as, like, they're accompanied by parents or something. I don't know. How does that work? Do you know?
No.
I mean, I guess it doesn't matter. We don't need to sit around talking about Star Cinema's attendance policies. But still, yeah, it pulled a lot of the kids that would have probably been in the theater. You know, they weren't there. So it was just four adults that really had nothing to do at 1 o'clock on a Friday. But of that demographic, we all look disappointed.
Awesome. But
have you seen anything new recently?
I just went and watched Planet of the Apes. The Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I went into it with pretty high hopes. You know, I've been following it since they started releasing production stills like last year, you know? And so I've been super excited about it. And I'm going to go ahead and say it exceeded all of my expectations.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I thought you were going to go the other direction.
No, it was really, really good. I mean, there was a lot of it that was, let's see, how do I explain this? Basically, a bunch of apes standing around talking in sign language was a lot of the movie. But it was really good, though.
You're really selling this.
I know, right? I mean, it was really, really good. It was a lot more emotionally impactful than I thought it was going to be. You know, there was a lot of good character moments, a lot of you feeling for, you know, these monkeys. Well, apes, sorry. Okay.
You son of a bitch.
I know, right? but there was a lot of really good scenes. Andy Serkis did an amazing job as Caesar. Like,
yeah,
it was weird, you know, how much like swagger and bravado a CGI ape could have. You know, it was crazy. Basically, if anybody could ever get an Oscar for best actor, you know, while being in a mocap suit, I think it's that guy.
Do they not allow that?
I don't know. I don't think it's ever come up.
I think that when he was doing, what was that? I never really watched the Lord of the Rings movies, but what was his Gollum? What the hell was his name?
Gollum. Okay.
Yeah, I think they wanted to do that, like to nominate him for something during that, but they couldn't or something. I don't really know. So I don't know how that works, but
I don't know.
It
was crazy good though. So I recommend it.
I just saw actually in the news that the writer from a movie called Henry Pool is here, which was okay. It wasn't anything to write home about. But anyway, he got brought on board to adapt Lock and Key for a movie. And I think that I don't really know if it lends itself to a movie versus a miniseries or something. But I either way, it's very, like, it's interesting.
It would have to be multiple movies. There's no way they could cram everything into one.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
it would have to be like Harry Potter level of movie series, you know, where you get like eight of them.
I could see them doing it in two or three if they tried. I mean, they're not going to incorporate everything, which, I mean, if y'all haven't watched if you haven't read Lock and Key, oh my God, like that's an amazing, amazing graphic novel series. I wish we were reviewing that.
Well, we can one day.
Yeah. I mean, I'd have to reread them, but yeah, it was That was a great series. So, but yeah, I'm with you. I mean, it's too epic to cover in one movie, but you know, they could take a lot of the storylines out, honestly.
Yeah, but it's, I don't think it would have as much impact, you know, without some of the backstory. And I mean, I guess they could take out the backstory that goes like way back, like generational stuff. But
yeah, like whenever there, it shows like the dad and all his friends in high school and all of that whole story, or what?
No, there's stuff that's even further back than that.
Like, oh yeah, the colonial stuff.
Yeah,
yeah. They, I've totally forgotten about that. So yeah, they could pull that out.
Okay. Yeah,
but no. Either way, I think that it's kind of cool that they're, you know, they've talked about it for a long time, and
it was in development as like a Fox TV show, correct?
Yeah, they had a pilot, and then it wasn't received well. I think they screened it at a Comic-Con a few years back. But anyway, yeah, I would like to see that in whatever form it may take, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like this may actually end up being like the damn Dark Tower in the sense that we're going to keep hearing that it's adapted over and over and nothing really ever happens. But anyway.
I don't know.
Well.
Was there any other news or anything you wanted to cover?
No, not really. And I want to preface this with our intention is not really to cover any news per se, just stuff that appeals to us and like-minded people. Like, I really don't want to ever be in the situation where we're talking about, you know, what's new with the Kardashians and stuff like that.
Well, what if they're in a B movie?
Then yes. Oh my God. Yeah. I would watch that movie too.
But like, no, Paris Hilton in House of Wax.
I loved House of Wax.
I know.
So much so, I showed it to my wife, and I was like, "This movie is awesome! Oh my God!" And then she was just like, "Oh, I mean, yeah, it was good. Yeah. No, it's awesome." I had no clue why I loved it so much, but I do. But. Anyway, yeah, again, we're just not, you know, we don't really want to cover news for covering news, but no. Whenever cool shit pops on our radar, obviously, if we want to talk about it, this is our time to talk.
Yeah.
So,
I don't know. There wasn't anything really else that interesting that happened this week, to me anyway.
No.
So.
No.
Moving on.
Yeah, we'll be right back with our book review of Bullets and Fire. We'll see y'all then. All right, we're back with our book review for Bullets and Fire. Brian, now, have you ever read anything by Joe Lansdale before?
I have not. I am completely unfamiliar with this author. I read it because you told me to.
Yeah, and I told you to because I think that this book, I had read it once before, and I felt like this is a good introduction. It's short. It's like 40 pages or so. But it's a good introduction to Joe Lansdale's, you know, to him in general. Mm-hmm. He writes a lot of genre fiction, whether it be firmly rooted in reality, like this was.
Yeah.
Or you know, some that incorporate supernatural elements. He actually wrote Bubba Ho-Tep, which I never really read the book. I saw the movie.
Okay.
But I've a lot of what I've read of his actually hadn't been hadn't been horror, though I have read some of his horror shorts in some of the compilations that I have.
Okay.
But he tends to either write horror or crime. Now, people that have read a lot more of his than me might know that he writes about elves and fairies and shit, and I just don't know, you know. But from what I read, I think that this, it's a really good story that showcases his writing style, and it's free on Amazon. So if anyone wants to pick it up, I suggest picking it up. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's a short read. It's a short read, but it's worth it. You know, it's entertaining. So,
did you? Now, just a little bit about the story. It's kind of a revenge. It's a revenge story about a guy joining a gang responsible for some things that happened in his life, mm-hmm. and just him trying to get revenge. And the one thing, depending on how you look at it, either you're going to love or hate about his writing style, is he definitely jumps in and uses a lot of slang, a lot of colloquialism.
Yeah.
And I mean, that can be detracting from the story, or it can, you know, really help add to the realism. And in this case, I liked it. How did you feel about that?
So there were parts of it that were really effective when he was talking to the two main gang members that he talks to for the majority of the movie, or for the majority of the book, you know, and they would be explaining a situation or talking about a story, and they would go off on tangents and correct each other and stuff like that. And I thought that was really well done, really organic, like what you would actually hear if two people are telling you a story together. You know, they're going to be constantly correcting details and things like that. But I mean, there were certain points where I don't have any specifically in my notes, apparently, but you know, where it's a little uneven. Sometimes there were lines that stuck out as jarring that were maybe against the colloquial use from before. You know, he would like throw in a more developed, you know, metaphor for something, and it was just kind of strange. But I mean, overall, I think it went really well and fit in with the tone of the story. But
yeah. The one thing my and I'm not really here at all to criticize at all on especially writing, because that's, you know, I write. I'm not as prolific as I'd like to be, but I write, and it's my intention to continue writing, and so I don't really want to dog anyone on anything, but he's what dog? Yeah. Anyway, no, I don't want to really dog anyone's writing at all, especially someone as prolific and good as he is. My only criticism actually is I think that this would have been awesome to have adapted into a full-length novel, mm-hmm. or even a longer short story, because it seemed like the first and second act were drawn out, and then the third act just went by really quick.
Yeah, there were parts of it like, okay, you know, it starts off with him doing his deed. I'm not going to say what it is because it's hilarious. And it's the, like, basically the opening line of the book. And it caught me by surprise, and it made me want to keep reading. But
I wouldn't think of what you were talking about. And I was like, what in the hell is he talking? But yeah, no, that's funny. I mean, it's jacked up, but it's funny.
And so there's some things that, you know, could be better fleshed out, you know, if it were a longer piece. Like, was he doing it on purpose? Was he joining this gang to get his revenge? Or was he joining it because he had nowhere else to go? You know, you learn over the course that basically the rest of his family is gone, you know, and so is it like an act of desperation that he tries to join in with his gang members, or is it, you know, cold calculated revenge? You know, and it's never really clear on that.
See, and I didn't even have that question. To me, it was clear and simple. He knew that these people were responsible for some of the things, and it was cold, calculated revenge. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I guess now I don't really know. I think it says in there. He knows for a fact that he's wanting to get revenge on these people. But you're saying, like, just because he doesn't have shit up, like, nothing else going on in his life, or what?
Yeah, because at this point, you know, his brother is dead, obviously. His dad killed himself because of it. It never mentioned...
Spoiler!
I told you there'd be spoilers! but, I mean, it never... I mean, honestly, if somebody, you know, wants to read this book, they can knock it out in a day or so easily. You know,
easily.
And come back,
it's 40
and listen
pages
to the review. You know, there's no mention ever of, like, a mother or any other family that he has to turn to. So, I mean, it could be still cold, calculated revenge. It could be a little bit of both. You know, it's not really clear. It just kind of jumps in with him already past his initiation.
Yeah, I got you. I just, you know, I didn't really think about that. But, yeah, you're right. Hell, I don't know. Maybe it says it somewhere in there and we just didn't take note of it. all in all, no, I think it's a really good, really strong piece of, you know, crime fiction.
Yeah.
And the characters, oh my gosh, these characters are very well drawn. Like, they're very well,
rendered,
you know, fully realized. They're fleshed out. They're really realized characters that seem real.
Which is kind of hard to do in, like, 38 pages.
Yes, yes. I mean, this book, you know, you could take just a classic tale of revenge, and that's pretty much all this is. You could take and write it in 40 pages, and it suck.
Yeah.
But that's not the case here. It's really good. It's very strong. I know that he's about to blow up big as an author, because I mean, he's already, from what I understand, been making his living for a long time just writing and stuff, but I don't know, he's got a movie with the guy that played Dexter, Michael C. Hall,
something like that.
It's called Cold in July. Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to be awesome. Now, I think that it's just kind of in a limited theatrical run and on VOD, and it's not on any of my VOD outlets, otherwise I would have watched it. But from what I understand, that movie's gotten really, really good reviews, and they're looking for additional source material to adapt from them. So I think he's definitely someone to keep on your radar, because you're going to be seeing more of him either way. But I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And I would recommend definitely for anybody to read it. But do you have anything else to say about
it? Yeah, I would say, you know, if you're a fan of, you know, your typical like crime noir, it's going to be something you'll enjoy. I mean, it's not your standard hard-boiled detective, but it definitely still has that crime novel feel. If you're a fan of 80s action movies like American Ninja or Last Dragon, you'll also enjoy it as well. It kind of took me by surprise, but there's some karate involved in it. and maybe not as much as I would have enjoyed. I really enjoyed that scene where he was describing what was going on while he was fighting. It reminded me of certain comic books and things, like Batman does it a lot, where he has an inner monologue where he's beating up on some criminals and things like that. And so that was really entertaining. I would have liked to seen maybe a little bit more of that. And I think if it was fleshed out, you could have gotten, a better feel for that. I thought it was interesting to see in book format, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know how many karate books there are.
I don't know. And I also don't know how many books actually make mention of I hit him so hard that he crapped his pants.
Yes. You know? Yeah, exactly. Like,
I thought that was funny. But yeah, I would definitely recommend it. Jump on it, especially while it's for free on Amazon. Yeah. And excuse me, I didn't really read the section where it said that he wrote this. What did he write it for, Brian? Like just a magazine?
He said he. Hold on, let me go back to the foreword real quick.
Okay. He basically.
Oh, you got it.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just saying he was asked to write a really hard boiled story for a magazine. So I don't know what magazine it was or if it ever actually got published in the magazine. But yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't really say.
But it definitely, you know, it got our approval.
Yeah.
That's pretty much all that matters. All right. So each week we want to interview some sort of creative and have a review, whether it be a book or a movie or, you know, maybe even comic book. I don't really know or care. Just stuff that we like. But we like to, you know, have an interview with somebody that's productive in one format and then review a different format. So this week we got a book review. And an interview with Billy Garbarina, who's been in so many movies. This dude was really cool to talk to also. I mean,
yeah,
he was a really, really cool guy. And I think, you know, I've been a fan of his work for quite a while. And it would have sucked just as a fan if he had been an ass. Although I don't really think that I would have shared it on the podcast if he was an ass. But either way, he was a really nice guy. And so I was very happy, especially for our first interview, that he was willing to, you know, just be so humble. We went through a lot of technical difficulties getting this review, and he was just really cool. So anyway, we got an interview with Christina Escamilla, who's a local writer. I guess she's local to us. I believe she's from Houston. She's not local everywhere. She doesn't just live everywhere.
She's omnipresent.
Yeah. No. And so she's a writer, and really I tried a sample of her book, just not even with the intention of talking to her on the podcast, but I tried a sample just during a lunch break and I was like, holy crap, this is amazing. Really, really good book. It's called The Day the Words Went Away. I think that it's 99 cents on Amazon right now. It may have gone up.
It was $1.99 whenever I got it.
$1.99? Okay.
Yeah.
So I think I actually, yeah, you know what? You're right. It's $1.99 on Amazon. But yeah, it's a very good book, and I highly recommend it. But we'll get into more of that next week. Coming up next, we're going to be talking with Billy Garbarina. Will you stop? Banners, boots, and bodies crushing bodies picked up off the floor. You die to hear your favorite song. Radio Deadly, Radio Deadly, yeah. Radio Deadly, whoa. Dying days of dreams will smash our TV. We're back with Billy Garbarina, writer, director, actor, and producer. His newest movie is called I Heart You, and it's available through all the major media channels, Best Buy, Amazon, Vudu, quite a few more. I'm sure he'll be willing to talk about where you can get it. Anyway, Billy, can you give us a quick synopsis of your new film?
Yeah, basically it's Mr. and Mrs. Smith meets Silence of the Lambs on a $10,000 budget. You've got me and Rain Brown playing opposite each other as Walter and Liz Fletcher. Kind of a bored, very kind of romance has gone cold suburban married couple that turns to their alter egos of serial killers when the doldrums of daily life kind of hit them, and they try to find a new spark and lease on life in picking up old habits that they thought they left behind. So they become obsessed with each other's alter egos in the newspaper, and a bloody comedy of errors ensues.
Yeah, me and Brian, we both picked it up on Vudu, and it was really good. It was definitely the picture perfect suburban mentality, just kind of going insane. And I definitely enjoyed it. It was a very original take. You know, I know you mentioned Mr. and Mrs. Smith, but that didn't even come to my head whenever I was watching it. I guarantee you haven't really seen any movie like it. It's very good. And you directed and you starred in it as well. Now, Rain Brown, your co-star, did she play any other role as far as the production of it?
Oh yeah, she was the producer of the movie. She actually the story of I Heart You goes back a few years. Raina and I we met on the set of Chris Rufty's Psycho Holocaust, which we shot in Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
And then from there, we ended up hanging out again on the set of Alex Birrell's Brain Cell that we shot in Liverpool, in London, in England. And then we met again on the set of Chris Seaver's Geek Wars. And so over the course of time, Raina and I have become very good friends. And, you know, speaking to a problem a lot of actresses have with the industry, a lot of actresses are extremely frustrated with the fact that, you know, it's kind of a TNA-based kind of system, and, you know, a lot of actors, female actors, are only really ever offered roles for strippers and prostitutes. And so, you know, in talking with Rain, you know, it's like, well, speaking as an actress, what kind of a role would you want to play, and what kind of a movie would you want to make? And we started to kind of co-construct the story for I Heart You, which was kind of a war of the sexes, and kind of a balanced look of, you know, man's perspective on marriage, woman's perspective on marriage, and kind of interpersonal difficulties and drama. And we kind of just developed the idea from there, and then we handed it off to a friend of mine, Devin O'Leary, who's now in three movies that I've directed. And he just kind of took the script and ran with it. And, you know, years later, we've got I Heart You.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned her wanting to, or about women's portrayals in movies, because I was going to ask if there was a deliberate sexualization of her murder scenes, because it seemed like when Walt was killing people, it was just sort of a visceral outcry of a man pinned down in a life he didn't, you know, really want to be in anymore. But hers, it seemed so sexual and sort of even a dominatrixy kind of vibe. And so I was just wondering if that was deliberate, you know, that sort of take on things.
You're giving me a gigantic head. It actually gives me some faith in myself that somebody actually watched the movie and sort of got it. So that's awesome. In fact, that was actually a very deliberate thing that was done. You know, Walter kind of has this rich fantasy life, where you'll see him occasionally, you know, fantasize about, you know, different things, like he fantasizes about wanting to kill Liz, or he fantasizes about dead prostitutes in the bathroom, or he fantasizes about, you know, being cut on by his image of who the sweetheart killer is. But when you get down to the actual visceral expression, it's very kind of just dirty and very straightforward and kind of very uncreative for all intents and purposes. And by kind, you know, everything was just kind of shot and lit very starkly and very simply. But the sweetheart killer, by contrast, is an extension of Liz's persona, who is a vivacious, vibrant, go-getting, creative person. So, you know, her deaths are always, you know, in a variety of milieus and in a strange system of ways. Like, you know, she herself is a caterer and a cook, and so too is each dish that she serves in terms of these murders a little bit different and a little bit more, you know, fantastic. And so, you know, whereas Walter is struggling you know, to make peace with the dirty boy that he feels inside and then expresses it with these kind of milquetoast murders. The sweetheart killer actually lives her fantasies out. And so, you know, one of the things that I had the color correctionist do is as is involved in her scenes, the kind of the color ramps up from kind of a standard, you know, coloring that's on the set to kind of like a more purplish pinkish kind of fantasy light and then kind of fades back into it as you go back to reality. So there's actually a very deliberate attempt to kind of fantasize and sexualize Liz's kills. But what you'll notice is that Liz herself is never sexualized. Like, she is wearing the dominatrix outfit, but the men are more naked than she is, and she never really shows any skin. There's really no TNA. So there is that kind of quality of woman in control and men being the exploited element of her fantasy.
Yeah, and she even has a line about women's liberation and how, you know, maybe it's time that there is a female serial killer. It shows that, you know, women can do the same things as men can.
Yeah, and, you know, that was definitely a deliberate kind of point that we wanted to hit. You know, there were a couple of different things that we wanted to get at in this movie, which is, you know, we're definitely living at a time where I think an argument could be made that possibly we're making a shift from traditional patriarchal society to more of a matriarchal society where women are living longer, they're holding on to the purse strings more, they're getting, you know, political and executive positions of very high power and very high pay. More and more men are stay-at-home dads. And so, you know, we're kind of seeing a shift in the traditional paradigm. And as we see that shift, you know, I've noticed in the news, like, we've seen a lot more horror shows of women drowning their babies and them going nuts and stabbing people and things like that. So it's interesting to me that as women become more empowered, both financially and politically and in terms of power structure, so too do we see some of the dark side of women in society in terms of sexuality and fantasy and things like that. And that was definitely something that we wanted to hit on in I Heart You, and I think we definitely went there.
Fantastic. I don't know.
I bet you guys never thought you'd get such a savvy political discourse on a $10,000 slasher movie.
Yeah, it definitely. Go ahead, Brian.
Oh, I was just saying, you know, there's lots of, you know, little things like that we're picking up on, or like at the very beginning, you know, we talked about earlier, you know, that the paperboy scene at the very beginning delivering the papers to what looks like, you know, purely normal suburban homes, but inside every single one of them was a person with a deep, dark secret, you know, and it's just, there's a lot of little interesting things in the movie like that and commentary on, I guess, society in general.
Well, and yeah, there's the question of, you know, what is sex and what is a relationship and what is normal? What is being true to yourself? You know, one of the not so subtle things that we tried to shoehorn in there was the gay couple that kind of parallels Walter and Liz's own marriage. And what you have there is a situation where you're in a society where two people who should for all intents and purposes either be executed or locked up in an institution for the rest of their lives are, you know, perfectly happy to be led along their way to have a marriage and go about their lives, whereas these two guys who are just kind of these normal, average, you know, just gay dudes just can't even find a place to get married. So, you know, there definitely are some different kinds of questions that are raised by this movie, and, you know, sometimes subtle and in other ways not so subtle ways.
Yeah, it definitely was very politically, you know, subtly, but still politically charged slasher. You know, you never
You know, not for nothing, I think it's a triumph of independent cinema that, like, I feel confident that I can say that all of these messages were attempted and in some case successfully executed in a movie where I'm also, you know, choking prostitutes to death and cutting their faces. I think it's a very balanced movie. I think it's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it's the progressive psycho that it appears to.
It rides a fine line.
Well, I you first came on my radar through Feeding the Masses and your work with Richard Griffin. And then later I caught you in some of the Chris Seaver movies. And basically, I have never seen a dad the way that you portrayed him in Taint Light. Can you tell us anything about that?
It was just the script that Chris wrote. And, you know, you got to be careful when you unleash certain kinds of things on certain kind of actors. Because, like, what I like to do in this world is what I call evolve the idea. So it's like, all right, well, if we're going to do this kind of thing where in Chris Heaver's, you know, comedy universe, the dad is having this really kind of inappropriate attraction to his daughter and kind of these very inappropriate exchanges, non-appropriate paternal exchanges with his daughter, why don't we just go there? Why don't we just fully commit to it? Why don't we really go there? So, you know, it's like there's a line to cross. And it's like, okay, you could, like, poke your toe over the line. Or maybe you could step over the line. Or maybe you could dance back and forth over the line. But me, I like to just hit the ground running and, like, find myself about a mile past where the line is drawn. And I think that definitely happens with that relationship in that movie.
Yeah, it was creepy, to say the least. So good job.
What's really creepy is how many teenage girls tried to friend me on Facebook after seeing me in that performance. God, that's creepy.
You know, you've worn a lot of different hats in the business as far as producing, directing, acting. Which one do you find the most enjoyment in?
Well, that's a tough question. You know, at the end of the day, I think that directing actually is probably the one that I'm finding as time goes on, as I'm getting a little older, the most satisfying, because you really get to kind of sculpt. I mean, if you're keen and you're using your images correctly and you're using your actors correctly and you're using your script correctly, you know, you can really do a lot of things, both simply and complexly, to tell a story. And you know, just kind of having that capacity to guide the audience on a journey with a good script and with good actors and with a good technical crew to create some good images. I really, really like that. Producing is something I'm good at. I can crack the whip. I can get things together and get them done, but it really is a thankless job. I have nothing but respect for people who produce, because, you know, they do all the work and they get very little glory out of it. But, you know, it's also really cool to every now and then get a really good performance and a memorable character. And, you know, sometimes it's really good to get out your own words and your own, you know, script, you know. So, I don't know. I kind of have found myself doing a little bit of everything, and I probably will continue to do a little bit of everything for as long as I can.
Cool. Well, I didn't see High 8, but from what I understand, it's a it's an anthology for all the directors that are known for shooting their stuff on video, as Chris Seaver has been doing recently with his Warlock video label. And I noticed just on your IMDb that you were in a segment of High 8. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because that's one of the newest credits that you have.
You know, it's just this weird little short where I'm stalking this woman all day, and then, like, I'm finally in her house, and it turns out I'm there to warn her that she's about to get raped, but then I get my neck broken, and then the guy then shows up and then tries to have sex with her, but then she has a giant dong and then starts raping him. It's a very perceiver kind of short.
That's like a Shyamalan little twist there.
Yeah, it really is. You know, it's like a twist within a twist. You think that the creepy rapist is going to be, you know, doing his thing, but it turns out that he's just a warning. But it turns out that the actual rapist needed the protection in the end from a big hairy dong.
good old dongs.
The old rubber dong and the hot chick with boobs angle, huh?
oldest yeah, trick in the book.
That's, yeah. If I had a dollar for every time that happened.
Yeah. You try to accost a woman and it just turns out she has a bigger dick than yours and, you know, puts you in your place. It's something no man should have to go through.
Now you're part of a group, basically like you and Debbie Rashawn and Chris Seaver, Rain Brown, Misty Monday, although a little less so. Basically, y'all are like pinnacles of B movies, and I use that term with affection. Basically, I just kind of imagine a room or a world where you and Trent Haga and Debbie Rashawn all just hang out. Is there some sort of like camaraderie between all of y'all? Or no?
There has been here and there over the years. Like I know Debbie and Trent have been really good friends for years. I only ever met Debbie once on the set of Teenage versus the Mutant Nazi Apocalypse. I mean, she's super sweet. She's super professional and a joy to work with. And it's actually kind of funny because we know all of the same people in common. And I think that's the conversation we had when we finally met. It's like, we should have met a long time ago. But yeah, you know, Trent and I have worked together on like 4 different movies now. As of Rain and I, and you know, it's just I'd say it's kind of more like we all kind of have our own things that we've got going on, but whenever we are able to get together on a set here or there, it's always a good time. You know, Rain's an absolute hoot. Trent is a funny, sick, twisted individual, and Debbie is just a sweetheart and a huge consummate professional. So you know, I wouldn't say like there's this like secret cabal of actors kind of sitting around hanging out on the back end. Like, in fact, we all live in very, very different places and lead very different lives, but yeah, whenever we get together, at least from my perspective, I've always had a great time just kind of tooling around and joking around with any given one of them. In fact, you know, me, Trent and Chris hanging out one time after Ski Wolf is exactly where Deathbone came from, because we went to watch John Rambo, and it was the most absurd thing we'd ever seen. And you know, just after the movie, I started joking around, making, you know, Stallone jokes. And originally Deathbone was going to be Deathbone, but it was supposed to be like a mock-up of Death Wish 3. And Trent was going to play the leader of the evil gang. And somehow we went from me and Trent starring in like kind of a, you know, an urban gang warfare movie made by Chris Seaver to Swords and Sorcery Deathbone without Trent. So I don't know how Chris got from point A to point B, but thus Deathbone was born.
Yeah, that's basically kind of like an iconic type character. For anyone that's unfamiliar with Deathbone, the character, basically he's pretty much like Conan the Barbarian meets Rambo. Is that correct?
That's basically it. Basically, if Sylvester Stallone ever played Conan and was totally like over the hill, you would have Deathbone. You know. but there's an extra level of Deathbone that's very near and dear to my heart, which is, you know, before Deathbone, Teen Ape was the most misogynistic character in the LDP universe. And I kind of saw that as a challenge. And, you know, I took that ball and I ran it to the goalpost. And I think Deathbone definitely scores on that front. Because whereas Teen Ape, you know, has a variety of kind of things going on with his own hedonism and his own kind of quest for self pleasure and gratification, I think Deathbone really, really, truly is just somebody who doesn't understand. Like I guess Teen Ape understands he's a misogynist, but Deathbone really has no clue. And I think that cluelessness about his level of misogyny and abuse really just kind of allows him the breadth and scope to be just much, much worse of a human being.
That's awesome. Yeah. You briefly mentioned Ski Wolf. Do you have any interesting stories from the set of that?
You know, not really. It was just kind of a standard issue Chris Seaver movie. You know, he ran into a little bit of extra money than he normally would for a thing like that. So we spent it on, you know, us hanging out in the ski lodge for like 5 days, and we just had run of the place, ran around filming this goofy movie, and then we took off. It was was very different to shoot in the cold and in the snow. It gave me new respect for what anybody who ever had to shoot a Hoth scene in Star Wars went through. You know, it was so bad that the cameras got gummed up a couple times from being so cold, the lenses. But yeah, it was cozy. You know, it was fun, silly little movie, and we got through it. You know, I do remember at one point because we had Alex. I can't remember her name, but she's actually like a plus size porn star.
Yes, yeah.
And she's a sweet girl, but like they were trying to get like different people to have sex with her and videotape it. And I guess Casey Falker was convinced I would do it. He's like, "Billy, Billy will have sex." I'm like, wait, where did you get this idea? And like, thank God Chris had my back. He's like, "There's no way in hell Billy would do that." So they got somebody else to do it. So the things that come up in cinema. the plus size porn star shows up, and like, you know, you got to speculate about who's gonna. It's not the first time a friend of mine who was like shooting a porn scene tried to, like, a friend of mine was shooting a porn scene out in LA, and they were short a male actor. They're like, "Well, maybe Billy will come to it." Like, I don't know why, where I get this impression that I'll do porn, but.
Well, I
guess it's something that some of my male cohorts want to see me do, which is a little weird if I unpack that too much.
Yeah, it's always a guy pushing that.
It's always my guy friends who like want to see me do a porn scene. It's weird. No, awesome. Dude, how about maybe we don't do that?
Well, what do you have coming up on your radar?
We just premiered my next movie, Rotgut, here in Albuquerque. And if you look, you look it up online, you can actually find trailers for that. So we're just out of stage with Rotgut that we're comfortable sending around to festivals for submission. And pretty soon thereafter, we're going to be looking for distributors for that. So that's going to be the next big thing on the radar. I'm actually really, really, really proud of it. Visually speaking, I think it's the best movie I've ever shot. And in the meantime, I've got a few ideas that I'm kicking around to develop for my next project. I'm not sure yet what I'm going to shoot. I've got a few options. I haven't decided yet.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, is there anything that you'd like to plug before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'd like to send everybody out to go pick up a copy of I Heart You and some of the other stuff that I've been in. Stiffed was really well received, and I recommend anybody who loves my movies who hasn't seen Stiffed to check out Stiffed. Deckerville's always fun. Feeding the Masses, Stink of Flesh, all good choices, and I haven't even covered any of the Chris Seaver catalog yet. So, you know, I'm just really super grateful that people are watching my stuff and they're interested in it, and you know, I have a handful of loyal fans that hang tough and friend me on Facebook and follow what I'm doing. And, you know, and guys like you who are interested in, you know, talking to me and seeing what I've got going on. I'm just super grateful that I've got that stuff going on at all, because, you know, the way that the film industry's gone, it's getting harder than ever to get a movie made. It's getting harder than ever to get a movie out there in the world. So the fact that I'm continuing to get movies out there because people are interested in them and seeing them, it's really kind of humbling, and I'm really grateful for you guys for this opportunity to promote my stuff, and for anybody who's a fan and is interested in my stuff, and especially your wives who you've reported like are checking out my junk in the I Heart You scene. So please send my love to them as well, and you know, tell them that I'm available on Facebook for friending and for
junk pictures,
deep conversation. If they're interested in some deep philosophic and artistic conversation.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on, and we both enjoyed. Well, I'm assuming Brian enjoyed I Heart You. I enjoyed I Heart You. I advise everybody, if you want to see a slasher about suburbia gone mad, I definitely advise that it's something that you should. You should check out, and we really appreciate having you.
And anytime you guys want to check in, or any fans, I'm on Facebook, so you can always find me there if you guys want to ask any questions, or just, you know, keep tabs on what I've got going on. Facebook is a great place to find me for anybody who is a current or future or past fan who wants to keep tabs.